Good morning again. I'm Rick Hansen. Can you hear me all right with the sound system? Okay, great. A little louder might be nice. A little more, maybe that's all right. Thanks. Louder's good. All right. I want to welcome you all today. And it's perfectly fine that some people will still be trickling in as we start here. It's going to be obviously a large number of people here today. So I want to thank you for taking a beautiful day and being willing to be indoors, at least for some part of it. So if you can be equanimous about being inside over the course of the day, that'll be great. Okay, so just to introduce myself briefly, my own background is that I started meditating in 1974. It was very romantic then. I had long hair and I played the flute in the hills outside of Los Angeles and so forth. Very kind of intro with Zen, and then off and on since then I've been practicing in different traditions and got involved with Spirit Rock about 15 years ago. Along the way I became a psychologist and a parent and so forth, and here we are today, right? I've always been very interested in what in the world is causing happiness and suffering. When I was a little kid I had a very strong sense of the needlessness of a lot of the unhappiness around me. In my friends, the school, my family, the world, and so forth. And later on in life, I became interested in the brain because of all the causes streaming through us that lead to happiness and helpfulness or suffering and harm, the final common pathway of all of them is the nervous system, and its headquarters is in the brain. So if we can understand the causes and conditions of happiness or suffering in the black box, you know, in the 3 pounds of tofu, if you will, between the ears, then we really have a growing capacity to influence those causes for better rather than for worse. And that's what really brings us here today. So starting around, I'd say 5 years ago, I began developing material that connected psychology, neurology, and contemplative practice, especially Buddhism, particularly in terms of what could be useful at the intersection of those three circles. And so it's in that context that we're going to talk about equanimity today, particularly with an eye toward skillful means, which is both the orientation of the Buddha, one that is empirical, grounded in fact, take nothing on belief alone, see for yourself, he was the first to say certainly, not in human history, but in this tradition. And then also pragmatic. See what's useful. See what works. That's the primary matter here. So in that context, why don't we dive in? All right. So equanimity in Buddhism is a combination really of three things. Balance, steadiness, and presence. In other words, one is engaged with the world, but not troubled by it. And as the slide says, guided by values and virtues, not reactive patterns. And to attain equanimity is both a matter of daily practice, that we start wherever we are, and the ultimate fulfillment of equanimity, if you think about it, is a fundamental snipping of the chain of causes that lead to suffering. So it can be developed to a very, very high degree. Today, my intention is to do a combination of presenting information, experiential exercises, which are always free to opt out of or go your own way with, sharing, and of course, the all-important breaks. Breaks are very important for equanimity. So some words about the logistics of the day. Feel very free to get up and take a break whenever you're moved to do so. It's okay also to bring drinks into here and even as well as eat in here. I will take a couple of official breaks, as it were, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and then we'll have an hour for lunch in the middle of the day. There are also handouts. If you don't yet have a handout, we printed 200. And so if we need more than that, we'll happily print them, and they'll be available certainly by the first break this morning, if not sooner. Does anyone need a handout? Trying to get a count. So it looks like we're going to want to print at least 10 more, maybe 20 in round numbers. Okay, great, because I'm sure there'll be more people coming in as well. The other thing, if you're here for continuing ed credits, and just for a show of hands, how many of you are in a helping profession? In other words, you're paid to help. It's like, yeah, okay, teachers, therapists, the whole kit and caboodle of health practitioners and so forth. Thank you. So a fair number of people in the room. As a sidebar to that, I will happily get into, oh, we can't block the aisles, alas, so well. I will happily get into some things related to applying these methods and perspectives in helping profession settings. But on the whole, I think it's really valuable to keep looking internally all the while. Why does this matter to me? What's the takeaway for me about that? How can I actually use that? I mean, that was, of course, the ultimate test of the Buddha, and I think it's one that keeps us grounded here today. So the handouts, you got them. I will tend to move along. I tend to err on the side of, you know, really going after a fair amount of material. I'm quite happy about this today. I was telling friends that I'm quite excited, and so I have to kind of manage my excitement and integrate that with equanimity, because I'm going to present a fair amount of material that I have not presented before and also is not in the book, Buddha's Brain, that I wrote with Rick Mendias, a neurologist. So I'll keep moving along. Feel free to ask questions as we go, but I'll also take kind of more formal opportunities for questions and discussions along the way. So back to CE. If you want CE, make sure you've signed in. If you haven't, don't worry. You can do it at the break retroactively. We'll trust that you've been here all the while. And be sure to sign out and also collect your certificate at the end of the day, if you could. Okay? So any quick questions about our logistics for the day? Anything I've left out? I'll mention it that there is a retreat up there, so please don't go past the gate where it says, please don't go past the gate. And on the other hand, feel very free to walk up in the hills. It's really quite lovely. This is a very beautiful and protected setting, quite special here. I was on the board at Spirit Rock for quite a while and have a real feeling for this place. Let's see, watch out for ticks, poison oak, all the critters, botanical and zoological, that might harm you. There we go. Okay, so let's dive in. The kind of point about equanimity, which sets us up for the day, is that it's a challenge. Because as the bottom says here of the slide, the ancient reactive circuitry of the brain is anti-equanimous. As we'll talk later, especially in the afternoon, the resting state of the brain really does rest on states that are doorways to equanimity. That's the good news. That's our home base. But we also evolve to be driven from home at the cough of a leopard, right? Or the crackle of a twig, or a frown in our primate band. You've probably noticed that, for example, everyone can be happily chatting away at a restaurant, but as soon as there's a tone of anger in the room, everyone gets quiet. What's that? You know, because that's how we evolved. So to cultivate the conditions of equanimity in the brain and in one's life, you know, is a long-term process. Okay, so I like these two quotes here. I think they really kind of say it in a very clear and clean way. You know, the Dalai Lama put it really quite well. You know, equanimity is not apathy. It's not indifference. It's not isolation. It is engagement, but it's an engagement based on calm reason and inner happiness. Okay? So in that context today, this is more or less what I want to get at. I'd like to do a survey of equanimity in Buddhist practice, then dive into self-directed neuroplasticity. That's a mouthful. It's the basic idea that you can use your mind to change your brain to change your mind. All right, and by knowing increasingly what the dotted lines are that connect mental activity to neural activity and therefore changes in neural structure, which then promote positive psychological states of happiness, love, wisdom, productivity, and so forth, then you increasingly can intervene inside your own head. All right, general methods for equanimity, I'll go through that fairly briskly. There are a number of general methods, and then in particular, I'll talk about the enlightened brain, which is kind of, overstatement slightly, but it's the notion that the resting state of the brain is naturally glad, peaceful, and loving, and quite close to equanimity, and how to use the methods with regard to the three fundamental motivational systems in our brain, which is to say to approach opportunities and what's pleasant, carrots. Second, to avoid pain and threat sticks. And third, attach to us. Okay, those are the three motivational systems. They can be tipped into a state that's full of suffering and reactivity. Look at the front page, watch the talking heads on cable news. You see right there, think about the last time you were upset about something, right, or stressed. Those three systems can tip into those reactive modes very, very easily. But it's also possible to ground them in their natural resting state, call that a responsive mode, the mind of an arahant or someone who's awakened or someone along the way toward that, that we can do increasingly ourselves, taking the fruit as the path, if you will. And I'll focus on methods for those for doing that in terms of those three systems. And that'll be the bulk. I'll try to preserve time so we can really emphasize that today. And then at the end, I'll really go for the fences and try to talk about a very deep way of understanding and sometimes experiencing the common nature of matter, materiality, which includes energy, dark matter, and all kinds of quantum weirdness and stuff, the common nature of matter and mind, the deep common nature, which is fundamentally eddies in the stream that are endlessly emerging and vanishing away in the razor-thin slice of time that we call now. And the implications of that are really wild and wonderful and very undoing immediately of the causes of suffering. So we have a lot to do today, don't we? Okay. And mingled into that, I really am going to do a number of practices with you. Yeah, please, in the back.
Quick question, it's more logistic. Are you open to questions throughout the day?
Yeah, I'll tend to keep going because I want to buy time for that in a coherent way, but definitely, that's true. Thank you. And so that was a question about a question, right? So very good. That was a process question, we say in shrink land, but anyway. You've probably noticed these microphones. We're going to record two presentations today for posting on Dharma Seed, far and wide. One will be a guided practice, which we'll do this morning, and the other will be kind of a talk about the enlightened brain. I'll do this afternoon. Also, I'm recording the whole day for posting on my website and also the website of the Institute I founded, the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. Those talks are freely available. I'll also post the slide set for this day, which is again freely available, like just most things I do. And you also have the handout. So just please know that the mics, I generally do not record what people say. I'll repeat questions rather than taking the time to pass around the mic. Please just say it loud enough, at least for me to hear it. I'll repeat it or summarize it, and then we'll go on from there. Okay? But on the other hand, which helps me make an important point too, this is not a therapy session. The nature of equanimity is that it can go to very painful topics, even traumatic ones. I'm just deep, like, real feeling for that. Take care of yourself. You know, it is generally true that the further into the deep end of the pool we go, the more value there is. But please make sure you can get back to the shallow end on your own. Okay? Okay. Okay. So, moving along. We're going to work at this common ground right at the center of these three circles. All right. I'm really happy to bring in the brain science part. On the other hand, as the next slide says or points or alludes to, the truth is that notwithstanding all these, you know, cool slides of what's happening in the minds of monks or nuns when they're in a very deep state of spiritual development or interesting molecular studies of the activity at the synapses and whatnot, the truth is that neuroscience is a baby science. The amount of knowledge about your brain and mine has doubled in the last 20 years. That's amazing. We know twice as much today than was known in 1990. But in many ways, I think that neuroscience is roughly where biology and neuropsychology is where medicine was about 100 years after the invention of the microscope, which is to say around 1725. So, as Tenzin Palmo says here, she, by the way, is an English woman who spent 12 years in a cave in Tibet and another 12 years or so on retreat. So I respect her a lot. And as she says, you know, we're thinking constantly, but no one yet knows what a thought is. All right? No one yet knows how in the world the meat produces the mind, really, in terms of conscious experience. How the movement of information through the nervous system becomes you know, lived experience at the most basic level, you know, the taste of a chocolate or the color red. Okay. So with that, you know, so let's have a kind of humility here. Okay, so to frame what we're talking about in terms of equanimity, I think it's useful to create a kind of an overarching structure. In other words, if you think about it, you can intervene in three domains. The world, which includes relationships, or as Jean-Paul Sartre said, as only a French existentialist could, hell is other people, right? So we can intervene there, right? We can also intervene in the physical body, super important, and we can intervene in the mind. Sometimes people pose them as either ors, they're not. They're all really, really, really important. Different people have different strengths in different areas. It's useful to think about what would be good for you in terms of balancing things and also what's useful at any given moment. That said, the possibilities of intervention in the world and the body, which is where people typically intervene, are really quite limited. Whereas the possibilities of benefit for intervening the mind are actually much greater. One, you have much more influence there. Two, you take it with you wherever you go. You know, wherever I go, there I am. All right? Okay. So that's where we're going to focus today. It's not that I don't think it's important to deal with the world, including structural factors that are oppressive and terrible. 1 in 5 children in America lives below the poverty line. 1 in 4 in California. It's astonishing. 1 million kids every year go through homelessness. There's oil gushing out in the Gulf, you know. All those things are true, but dealing with the mind doesn't mean we don't deal with them. If anything, it actually helps us, I think, deal with those things to do so with that quality of balance, spaciousness, and presence, you know, that are the fundamental attributes of equanimity. Okay, so also to create kind of a context here, it's interesting that I think that there are really three phases to any kind of personal growth or healing. And they map very interestingly to the three fundamental pillars of Buddhist practice, which also map very interestingly to the three fundamental functions of the nervous system. It's really kind of nice, you know, when the dots sort of line up that way. So as you know in Buddhist practice, or you may know, the Buddha said that really this life is about virtue, mindfulness, often translated as concentration, samadhi, which includes very deep states of contemplative absorption and steadiness of mind, as well as wisdom. And it's interesting that you see those three pillars in other traditions as well, including Christian contemplative practice, as well as the other great contemplative traditions throughout the world, including the shamanic ones, which often don't get enough credit. So, you know, virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom. Interestingly, those map to the three central functions of the nervous system, which is to say regulating, that's virtue, a lot, you know, keeping things in range, restraint, and so forth, you know, that. Two, learning and receiving, that's the mindfulness or concentration side, which is, you know, another function of the nervous system. And then last, selecting. I think the essence of wisdom is choosing a greater good over a lesser one, right? It's easy to choose good over bad. The tough choices are good over good. All right, and so those correspond actually to the three phases. If you think about it, the first thing we need to do when something comes up that's painful or difficult or upsetting or reactive or harmful is ideally to be mindful of it, to hold it in spacious mindfulness. That's critically important, right? To experience it, to be with it, to, as Pema Chodron says, to bear it, to stay with it. Sometimes that's enough, but often it's not. Mindfulness alone is often, probably, usually, in fact, not curative. The Buddha stressed many, many things besides mindfulness alone, yet I think there's been a tendency in Buddhism in the West, in certain quarters, to really emphasize mindfulness alone, as if it's all there is to it. And among other people, Jack Kornfield, a very esteemed founder, really, of Spirit Rock, has been very forthright, including in his recent book, The Wise Heart, to point out that that's a problem. That's not the Dharma, and it's not the way life really is. There are other phases as well. So at a certain point, it becomes skillful to move to the second phase of letting it go, or releasing, or helping whatever that afflictive mind state is to move on. All right? That just right spot, I think, goes to what I think is the greatest Dharma story of all time, Goldilocks and the Three Bears. In other words, it's that just right place, right? where it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's not too tall, it's not too short, it's just right. We can feel it. People tend to, you know, make two errors, if you will, with regard to the mindfulness phase, either staying there too long or too briefly. I tended to skip over it because, like, pain, forget about it. I'm a California guy, you know, suffering, ooh. And then I know other people who just get sucked in. It's like a black hole, you know, and they do one more lap in hell, which is not good. Right? So at the just right spot, we move on to the second phase, letting go. And there are a lot of technologies, methods, clinical practices, and so forth. And then the third phase, also very important, is to let in, is to replace what we've released with some positive alternative through cultivation. All are really important. The three phases often move sequentially. Sometimes, so you have to jump to the third to build up resources so you can do the first, so you can bear to stay with what's there, right? And all the rest of that. But again, these will be three themes that we will be working with today in reference to equanimity. And as with domains of intervention, it's not either or. All are really important. I will tend to focus mainly on the second and third phase. It's not because I don't have respect for the first one. I think the first one's the foundation of success in the other two. It's just that the emphasis today will be on the second and third phase. Okay? So, how does equanimity fit in? You know, where is equanimity in Buddhist practice? And what I'm going to want to do, and equanimity in a way is not very sexy, right? And yet it's deeply important. So I'm going to do a fair amount of just kind of surveying of the key aspects of equanimity and try to be somewhat comprehensive about it. So I ask your forgiveness in advance if you feel a little flooded by the end of the day. Fear not, you know, it'll sink in and it'll all be good. Okay, so insight is very fundamental to equanimity. First, for example, there's the recognition of what the Buddha called the three characteristics or the three marks of existence. First, that everything changes. Second, that everything is connected to everything else. And third, if you don't get with the program, you're going to suffer. Right? In other words, if you resist the fact that things are impermanent or resist the fact that they're interdependently arising so that nothing exists in itself, including the sense of being an I looking through the eyes at the world, then we create the conditions of suffering and harm. Right? Recognizing that with increasingly real-time clarity and with increasing granularity into the details and nuances of experiencing and interacting. You know, we're very embodied. We are embodied. We're not very embodied. We are purely embodied. It's like being very pregnant. No, we are totally embodied and inactive in the world. Recognizing that everything is changing, it's hopeless to cling, it's foolish to just think that anything, including ourselves, is in any way fundamentally separated from everything else, that creates suffering. So we have a deepening insight there. Also, with insight, we elaborate that in the way the Buddha did through a recognition of suffering, a diagnosis of the cause of suffering, which is to say, craving. And we're going to talk what that nature is of craving and the distinction between craving, whose root in Pali, which is the language of the earliest surviving written record of the teachings of the Buddha, is thirst, tanha. It really gets at that visceral quality of craving. There's clearly a distinction between unwholesome desire, if you will, and the wholesome desires that lead to welfare and happiness, including, for example, a desire to come today, or to for your children's welfare, the welfare of your friends, or your own welfare. Those are wholesome desires. The root of suffering is not desire, per se. The root of suffering is, in the Buddhist view, at least, is craving. And fundamentally, the root is ignorance. So through insight, we undo those fundamental causes of suffering. So that was the second noble truth. The third noble truth is the prescription. The Buddha's often been likened to a physician who sees the malady, diagnoses its cause, craving, identifies the treatment, and then fourth, prescribes a course of treatment, a path of treatment, which is to say, the Eightfold Path. Right? And we nest equanimity in that larger understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Okay. And then an analysis of suffering that's very close to Western psychology and neurology is the chain of dependent origination, which usually has people's eyes glaze over, but is actually really cool and important and useful. The kind of practical heart of that chain is the sequence that flows from stimulus of any kind, something happens, inside, very important, as well as outside. And then there is what the Buddha called contact. There's the barest just presencing of it in consciousness or in the processing stream, you know, moving into consciousness, neurologically, contact. And then follows a feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, typically combined with some aspect of what the Buddha called perception, which is the third of the five aggregates or heaps or aspects of experience, perception, a kind of a labeling. And then comes our friend craving, because we crave the pleasant, right? We crave the ending of the unpleasant, and we crave that the neutral move on and get good, right? So that's craving. Then that craving, you know, really tends to build out and constellate. You can just kind of watch it happen in the processing stream, especially if the mind's quiet, within a few seconds into this more elaborated form of clinging, which then leads to suffering, right? Okay, we won't do call and response. No, no worries. I won't sing. People pay me not to sing. It's all good. Okay, so related to that, the Buddha then had this analysis that's really interesting of the first and second dart, because you see in this chain, the sequence, if we can handle the feeling tone, in other words, we can handle the pleasant, handle the unpleasant, handle the neutral, without reacting to it. The feeling tone is a reaction. It's hard to stop that reaction. Drop a brick on the foot of a Buddha, it will hurt. You know, the Buddha also was hurt in his heart when his friend, Sariputta, one of his main students, if that's the right word, died. You know, that's unpleasant. But to be able to hold the unpleasant or the pleasant in a great and stable spaciousness that has also an engagement with the world, that's the essence of equanimity. Equanimity is the internal shock absorber or circuit breaker that stops the sequence, that snips this chain that moves from the feeling tone to craving, clinging, suffering. One of the key things that helps snip that, maybe I'll just go through this and then open it up, is the recognition of the difference between the first and second dart. That's the Buddha's metaphor. The first dart is inevitable, let's call it discomfort, physical and emotional discomfort in life. Old age, disease, and death are first darts. No one escapes first darts in life. Besides physical discomfort, there is emotional discomfort. We evolved to be beings, we physically evolved, biologically evolved to be beings that are very connected to others and love and invest. And it's, of course, natural to grieve if something bad happens to or could happen to someone you care about, all right? Including oneself. So there's a lot of times first darts are spoken only of in the Dharma in terms of physical discomfort, but obviously there is inevitable emotional discomfort as well, right? Then the trouble really begins. When we add second darts to first darts, when we get mad, for example, that we're in pain, or we blame ourselves for being sad yet again somehow, right? Or we get activated when actually nothing has happened at all. It was not even a first dart, and we're throwing these second darts of our reactions. Grumble, grumble, why, bad, wrong, hurt, yuck, mad, duh, duh, duh. A little story. On the way here, I was driving through San Anselmo. I came to a four-way stop, one of these kind of complicated ones where multiple streets come together. I think I got to the intersection first, and in a not entirely mindful way, I just stopped, full stop, proceeded in the intersection, and then realized, you know, in the processing stream, that this large SUV had kind of moved toward me, driven by someone, and I... Because, you know, I could name but then there'd be that categorization, you know. See, so that's interesting to watch that. That's good. So anyway, so And then, which was fine, so that person stopped, and I stopped, and I, you know, kind of mellow, trying to warm up the equanimity circuits and the loving-kindness circuits on my way to, like, teach her today. Not a bad idea. I went, like, I kind of smiled and went like that, and the person just kind of looked stared stonily ahead and kept going, all right? And I watched the reaction. Like, wow, I wish that person had kind of smiled or acknowledged what a good guy I was. Yeah. And then suffering starts to begin, right? Kind of irritated, disappointed. Then the case starts coming in about people, those people, you know, who those people are, whoever they are. That's a second dart cascade. You know? Right there, I'm having a visual of like one of these woodcuts for Dante's Inferno. These little demons. Poke, 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 poke. Those are the second darts the mind throws. We throw ourselves. Okay? And then actually, why don't I finish the last two points, and then we'll take comments and questions, and then, we will move into a practice. Okay? So just to finish these out, in addition to this distinction between first and second dart, and actually, I should add, sometimes we throw second darts when good things have happened. People compliment us, right? Or an opportunity comes our way. Someone says, hey, would you like to do this? Or we'd like to do that. You know, and you're like, oh, my God, I'll mess that up. And second darts begin. Okay. And then the eight worldly winds. These are a nice distinction. You know, praise and blame. Fame and ill repute. Gain and loss. Pleasure and pain. The eight worldly winds. What equanimity is, if you imagine yourself as a sailboat, equanimity is the keel in the water. And as we grow more equanimous, that keel gets deeper and weightier. So that increasingly the winds blow, and these winds will blow. No one escapes the vicissitudes of these variable winds. All right? But they don't knock our boat over. Right, because we have equanimity in the water. They bonk us a bit, sure. We get a little rattled this side of perfect and enlightenment, all right? But basically the keel deepens in the water, and we live more and more based on values and virtues and a growing unconditional well-being and caring and kindness for others rather than going through life searching for a good breeze. Okay. And then last, kind of teaching, if you will, core teaching about equanimity, has to do with the notion of disenchantment. And I really like that term because it kind of gets at a lot. One, it has to do with waking up from a spell. And second, it has to do with a kind of clear seeing. In other words, one thing that supports an insight or a growing understanding that supports equanimity is this growing recognition about the imperfectibility of life. You know, Tenzin Palmo, the English woman whose quote we saw earlier about a thought, as I said, meditated on retreat in Tibet for many years, and she tells a story in her wonderful book, I think it's Reflections on a Mountain Lake, where she describes kind of a breakthrough moment where she was sitting in her cave. It was winter. It was snowing very intensely. I'm not sure how high she was, 14,000 feet, 20,000 feet, way up there. And then suddenly in her cave, a large collection of snow or ice, what have you, had accumulated above her, and it just completely fell on her and smothered her, basically. So there she is, middle of the night, middle of nowhere, no one's around, and she's smothered in snow. And initially there was this kind of reaction, right? Unpleasant. And then this like thought just occurred to her, just arose spontaneously. What did you expect from samsara? Samsara being a traditional term for ordinary existence. What did you expect from samsara? And in that moment, pew, there was an awakening. And so right there, it's, you know, not just in these high drama moments, you know, in a cave in Tibet, right? Just in ordinary life, you know, there I am at the intersection. What did I expect from samsara, you know, and all the rest of that. And so there's a growing recognition that, you know, this is life. You know, this is what a great cookie tastes like. That's what an orgasm is like. On the other hand, that's what pain is like. Either end of the spectrum, life comes and goes. And there's a growing kind of disenchantment. That's one of the stages of practice. Disenchantment, then dispassion, then cessation. You know, which is a technical term for a state that one gets to in a very deep state of absorption. But disenchantment and dispassion. That doesn't mean disgust. That's one of the ways that traditional word for disenchantment has been translated. The word is nibbida. You may know it. It's not really disgust. That would be aversion. It's just disenchantment. It's kind of seeing through it. Like, it's okay. And there's sometimes with it a subtle world weariness that is not aversive, but it's kind of like, this is it. You know, it's like, that's what keeps happening. The movie keeps running. The waterfall keeps rolling. You know, the galaxies keep twirling. Disenchantment. Okay, questions or comments so far? And then we'll do a practice. Yeah.
My question is about craving and a distinction I hope you can make.
Oh, I'll repeat the question, but sure, louder is good too.
The question has to do with craving. That it seems to me that that it's necessary to have high motivation in order to surmount the transitional suffering of change. And in a sense, we might say one craves to be out of suffering or to have peace. I find personally that peace and suffering gets me to get off my butt and do things that I wouldn't otherwise do. Or do because there's a positive wish for something more affirmative. While craving is inevitable, is it adaptive or transitionally adaptive? And if potentially not, what is the alternative?
Great question. So to summarize, I think the essence, if we don't crave, how do we be motivated toward wholesome ends, right? And how do we be motivated to not just be motivated toward wholesome ends, but to abide in and live from wholesome means, right? Wonderful question. And today, in a sense, is an attempt to answer that, especially in the afternoon. Because what occurred to me is that Buddhas do not stop brain function. You can't stop it. So how in the world do you, that's what really has interested me, to reverse engineer the nature of an enlightened brain and then work backwards for those like me who are not there yet, right, but are interested in at least moving as far as one can in this life in that direction. And the short answer is that as craving falls away, it is increasingly replaced with natural movement toward what's wholesome. The heart naturally moves toward what's good. Good for self, good for others. You know, the heart naturally moves toward that, and it's always been that case. And then I think what happens increasingly is the mind gets really quiet, and I see this in people. There's hardly even conscious intentionality. They're just lived by a natural goodness and a natural wakefulness, which, important sidebar, may ultimately partake of something transcendental. I want to bow in that direction, acknowledge that possibility. It's you cannot disprove it in science, so I think a truly scientific attitude is to accept it as a possibility. That said, many people, including myself, think it's likely and perhaps even have an experience of something transcendental that's at work in the mix. That said, I'm going to stay inside the smaller pond, you know, of the realm of Western science. So I think that's it. One way to think about it is that, in a sense, will can be redefined as to give oneself over to one's best self. That can be, in effect, a really good kind of will. All right, so I'll keep going here, a couple more, and then, because today, in a sense, is an attempt to answer that. Thanks. Yeah, in the back, and then, so you, yeah.
Regarding the second part, would the pattern of identifying oneself as a victim play a part in the first?
Right. Okay. So, does seeing oneself as a victim, turbocharge second darts? right? Yes, and. Okay, so yes, I think it's probably right there in your question, you know. But what do we mean by victim? I was the victim in some sense of that person at the intersection. Or more broadly, you know, we are the victims of all kinds of things. You know, the Gulf is the victim of British Petroleum, in some sense. Things happen to us. And the term victim has somehow become shameful. The truth is, things happen to people. They are legit, they are victimized. You know, things happen. And I think, paradoxically, recognizing that one has been bonked in some way by life or by a person, a boss, a partner, a parent, a government, a corporation, what have you, is very important. And then to not blame oneself for that, to try to tease apart what were my causes, what were their causes, what were nobody's causes, and then muster, as we'll talk later, self-compassion and kind of getting on one's own side and so forth. So I think there's a way to recognize, honestly, that one was bonked, that's actually really quite important. I think, honestly, for, you know, I'm a therapist, right? So I'm kind of in the trenches to some extent. And probably for every person I know, I've known, who is just sort of wallowing in their victimhood and wearing their reproaches on their sleeve, like big badges of honor and all the rest of that, and so forth, there are 10 people who are under-acknowledging the ways in which they've just been whammed by life, by one factor or another, and blaming themselves for it. So which is the more important error to avoid making, you know, statistically, if you will. That said, regarding oneself as helpless, regarding oneself as, and also getting, as we therapists say, secondary gain, you know, from the status of being mistreated, that's obviously, you know, marinating in second darts. And, quick point, you know, as mammals, we're incredibly vulnerable to learned helplessness. I mean, for example, studies on dogs who have a limbic system, an emotional system very much like our own, have shown that you can train a dog in helplessness in about 5 trials of inescapable discomfort. Right? But it takes many dozens of trials, even 100 or more trials, to retrain that dog that it can actually do something about his or her fate. We're the same way. That's why I think it's really important to be very careful in situations where we are at effect, things are pushing on us, and to keep focusing on what is possible to do. And that gets at that point earlier about domains of intervention and also the stages of practice, the 3 stages I said. To paraphrase Viktor Frankl, who survived Auschwitz, who was there for a while, he said, even in that most horrible of situations, there were always those among us who you know, comforted others, gave up their last crust of bread, and so forth, demonstrating that most inalienable of human freedoms, the freedom to choose one's way, no matter what the circumstances. In other words, one's attitude about it. You know, they may have my body, but they don't get my mind, right? And so to really focus on where one does have efficacy, where one is a hammer and not a nail, is actually really important to antidote this vulnerability we have to learned helplessness. Which also gets to those 3 phases of practice, as I said. We may not be able to let go of the upset. It just might be overwhelming, or the trauma. We might be re-triggered, you know. But we can always surround it with spacious mindfulness. We can always be aware of it. We can always name it. We can always be with it. Right? And feeling a cause in that regard is available to us at any time. You just have to remember it, and is a great refuge. Okay, last one, and then we'll move on. Yeah.
Chain of suffering.
Beg pardon. Chain of suffering.
The chain of suffering. Yeah. In the beginning, you gave a couple of examples. You said, you know, it falls on the Buddha's foot, it's going to feel pain. How there's the feeling. What would be the craving that comes out of that? Is it the craving to feel better?
Yeah.
How does that lead to suffering versus just feeling pain?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so talking about first and second darts and how they become craving, let's use the example of a brick falling on the foot of a Buddha or us. it's very natural for there to be an immediate response to, if one is thirsty, to reach for the water and drink, or if a brick has landed on one's foot, to move it off, or if someone has done some dread, you know, like over here, our child's in the hospital, you know, been rushed there from an accident in PE or on the playground, to get in that car and go. And that's, I don't think there's suffering in that. There's discomfort, there's upset, but we're not adding anything to it. It's kind of like added. What's added? If we start getting caught up in, you know, why was that brick there? Who left it on the shelf? You know, why did it hit my foot? Have you ever had the experience of stubbing your toe on something, you know, like not knowing it, and then hitting it, like the object? I have, I admit it. You know, like as if it's going to feel something, you know, getting caught up in that, that's where suffering begins, you know, where it's one thing, obviously, to really wish that one not experience chronic physical pain or emotional pain, where it starts and to be sustained in one's motivations there. I don't think that's craving, okay, as the Buddha meant it. I think where we get in trouble is when we get really caught up in an elaborated case about it, including, as we'll talk a little later on, where we bring in a lot of self about it.
Okay. So and like questioning the why of the brick falling on the
yeah. Yeah.
How yeah. I could have avoided the brick falling on my foot versus just accepting the fact that it fell on your foot and doing something about the pain.
Right, or getting caught up in a lot of attachment to a world with no bricks, right, at all. Or getting caught up in blaming oneself or always having bricks happen to me. There I am again, what a ninny I am, bricks happen to me, you know, whatever, you know, right, that. Right? Then we're getting caught up in it, or trying to make, you know, feverish plans to live life, never to encounter or risk bricks again. You know, things like that. That's where, yeah, exactly.
The brick is a sign that
yeah, exactly. You know, I'm cursed. It was a message from God. Never leave the house again. Yeah. Okay. Or never date again, or never marry again, or never apply for a job again, right? Or what have you. Okay. So. Tell you what, why don't we move on to a practice? And there will be the temptation throughout today, you know, craving, of course, sometimes, as well as wholesome desires, to keep talking and thinking about this will happen. But I thought we could do a practice. So as kind of a prelude for what we're going to do today, I thought I could introduce some of the major methods. And so this will be a guided practice, which means I will be talking. Many people, me included, tend to not care for guided practices that much and, you know, prefer to be quiet. That said, you know, I think of them as kind of a necessary evil sometimes, if you will. And then we can, then we'll go into a break right after the practice. And I would like you, if you could, to please be silent during the break, to kind of really let it sink in. It's easy to get quite heady and mental about this material, and there's a place for that. But as much as we can, let's truly try to end this day more equanimously, deep down, than we began it altogether. Okay? So if you could, you know, jump ahead a little bit, and we can swing back to some slides if you like. The slides that follow this one kind of just elaborate the points I've made with some text from the Buddha. Okay, so in terms of meditation, the basics, if you've never meditated before, are just to relax and stay present, you know, and kind of be here now, as it were. All right? So if you could, try to come to a place of alertness and comfort in your posture. Your eyes can be open or closed as you like, or you can change that as we go along. We're going to touch on different practices here. They're not designed to take you into ultimate equanimity, but to give you a taste, if you will. So you're going to do two things. You're going to try to do something, and then you're going to see what happens. And it won't always be successful, but that's part of seeing what happens. And this will take about 25 minutes or so. So to begin with, see if you could find some quality of compassion for yourself here and now, which means basic goodwill toward yourself and the wish that you not suffer, combined with a sense of tender concern. It could well be a fairly subtle sense, even just simply conceptual. You might put it into words with language like, may I not suffer? Or more specifically, you know, may this depression pass? May I not be so anxious? May I not worry so much about my son right now? Can you also find a sense of being on your own side, not against others, but for yourself, as one of the all beings that one is to be kind toward, the one wearing your name tag? You might call up a memory of a time when you were strong on your own behalf, maybe physically or interpersonally. I'll keep moving through these suggestions, but feel very free to dwell on one and not move along. That said, form an intention for a growing equanimity, a growing balance, openness, and engagement without suffering. That intention can be top-down, such as in words like, may I be equanimous, may my equanimity grow. It can also be bottom-up, by imagining being and embodying the qualities of someone who is for you something of a model of equanimity. Could be a teacher, could be someone in your life, perhaps the Buddha himself. The intention for equanimity. Next, really relax. Relax your body. Take several long exhalations. Relax your tongue. Really relax. All right. As you can, bring to mind some sense of connection with others, including perhaps the sense of being with someone that you know cares about you. So you're accessing feelings of belonging, connection, being cared about, being appreciated, as best you can, and allowing yourself to sink into those positive feelings. All right. Also, be aware of one or more things that bring a basic sense of gladness and well-being to you. Perhaps some things that you feel grateful for. World, children, a pet, friends. Maybe there's simply a subtle sense of peacefulness. Here too, see if you can open to and encourage, without straining or struggle, some basic, even subtle feelings of contentment or happiness. All right. And now see if you can bring to mind, open to and encourage, without strain or struggle, a sense of personal strength. Maybe recalling a time when you were strong. And with that sense of strength, explore the sense of feeling as safe as you reasonably deserve to feel. Not perfectly safe, but safer. Being aware of being in a protected setting, among good people. With resources in yourself and in your world to help you deal with what life may bring. Exploring the feeling of being able to feel less threatened or wholly unthreatened. and thus able to be less guarded, less vigilant, less braced against life. Be aware of whatever moves through awareness as contents, mental contents, moving through a vast and open space, like clouds across the sky. So there's a sense of a kind of panoramic awareness of experiences flowing through, a bird's eye view. Continuing to sink more and more deeply into a sense of equanimity as it is there for you, whatever is there for you. Also sensing that the benefits of this practice, whatever they are sinking into you, becoming woven into your being, a resource you can take with you wherever you go. And now, being aware of the sensations of breathing, felt in the belly, the chest, the throat, or around the upper lip, or in all those places, or in the body as a whole, see if you can sink into the sensations of breathing. With each and every breath, letting go of everything else for the next couple minutes. stay with the sensations of breathing, see if you can expand your awareness to a sense of the body as a whole, breathing here. The breath moving the body as a whole, the hips, the knees, even the ankles move with each breath. The shoulders, neck and head also move with each breath. A sense of being a body breathing, simply breathing, and abandoning everything else. Grounded in the simplicity of being a whole body breathing, be aware of the feeling tone of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, probably with quite a lot of neutral. Maybe seeing reactions in the mind arising to the feeling tone in the flow of experiencing. And maybe seeing what it's like to let the feeling tones come and go without reacting to them. resting in a growing peacefulness, be aware of the ways or some of the ways you're connected to things. Breathing air and air breathing you, connected to the whole atmosphere on this planet. Opening to a sense of connection with the natural world. An animal here in one of its habitats, also connected with other animals in our tribe or band. And connected as well to important people in your life. Them living through you in some ways in the mind, and you as well living ripples from you living through them. Not needing to crave others or cling to them, simply abiding in a peaceful, natural experiencing and knowing of already present connectedness. Sinking further into equanimity, it being perfectly fine to be aware of one of these themes and let it plant its seeds and then return simply to a growing sense of equanimity itself. Find contentment in simply being. Relaxing any grasping after a better moment. Opening to feeling increasingly tranquil. Intact and whole as experiences stream through awareness. releasing any fears, including subtle anxieties. Releasing any sense of being threatened. There may be difficult situations, but releasing any sense of being threatened that is added to them. Releasing any anger, any resentment. Any irritability. Finding little moments, little glimmers, or maybe long moments of releasing any aversion, any resistance to the present moment as it is. And thereby feeling increasingly tranquil. Accepting the moment without reacting to it. Being spacious and peaceful. Let each moment pass away. Let it all continually vanish so quickly. Continually letting go and surrendering to impermanence. See if you can move equanimously and in silence, unless you need to talk about something, go into a break now. If you have a Toyota Corolla, by the way, with the license plate 5SGM412, if you could please find another parking space because the person you're behind needs to leave sharply at 5 today. You haven't done anything wrong, but it would be helpful if you moved your car. This is a good time to sign up for CE if you haven't. Enjoy your equanimity. We'll take a 15-minute break. There are bathrooms here and also in the buildings out around the meadow, and people can direct you. And let's come back at 20 past 11.